Access number 29039, Mr. Alan Pollock, Real 20. Now, what about the organisation of these operational flights? I mean, how was an operation? How would it start from finish? Start to finish, I mean. What would the pattern be?
Well, roughly speaking, there were pre-planned strikes, which you'd have some degree of notice on. They often had been agreed the previous day, for instance, and it was probably they wanted a target being attacked by 4 aircraft, 6 aircraft, 2 aircraft, or what have you, or 8 aircraft, and there'd be below that there'd be an element of what we call flag wave operations, and a flag wave would be to, as it sounds, to show the flag to fly over a target in a way that would say to them, look, if you don't watch your step, it was to effectively display a hostile intention with, and that was often part of the successive development, if that's the right word, or deterrent factor for tribes that were misbehaving themselves, or because often it was tribe against tribe as much as tribe causing a problem with the federal government. With the pre-planned side, I mean, they were reasonably straightforward. Obviously, normally you would have at the top of the, or at the sharp end, you'd have your more experienced people leading. And what I didn't mention was that, and what was extremely good in Aden, and I would suggest from, you might say, oh, well, he'd say that at any rate, but I'd say despite that, that 43 squadrons' commitment and professionalism there, I think, was even better than 8 squadrons. Now, 8 squadron had been in the Middle East an awfully long time, and in many ways, you know, I'm not decrying their operations at all, but all I am saying is that I felt that 43 squadron had an extremely good induction, if that's the right word, in your first 3 months or whatever it would take, even for experienced pilots to be declared operational. And again, we spoke about this, that you'd have op 2, op 4, and then operational 8,
so you
and
had
then
to go
some
that
even operation. Yes, and in fact, it slightly niggled me at the time, because it was the tail end of Radfan then, and I was slightly champing at the bit and thinking, you know, wanting to be more involved earlier. But their system, I think, on reflection, was remarkably good. And part of the reason I say that was on the squadron at that time was somebody who later went up quite correctly to just below Chief of Air Staff, but people thought he was going to become Chief of Air Staff, and that was John Thompson. Now, John, I'd known as a senior, well, he was a senior under officer. He was in the penultimate entry just before he became senior under officer when I first remember him as a college cadet. But he was one of the last vampire courses, and then, well, not one of the very last, but in the last wave of the last year, say, of vampire courses, or year and a half, before going out to Aden. But when I caught up with him out in Aden, he was at the end of his first tour.
What was he at that time?
And he'd only be a flying officer then, having started probably almost as a pilot officer when he went out to start with. And it was really the accident to a great friend of his, who also I remember, Martin Herring, that caused that was one of the fatalities that caused my being able to get myself posted so rapidly, because Martin Herring had recently been killed, and to some extent it was probably not experience related, because it was to do with the baffles. We had these marvellous 230-gallon drop tanks, which sadly at that stage needed further modifications because of the degree of G that was being pulled, and the amount of 230 gallons that they had. Well, there was an awful lot of fuel slopping about forward and aft, and one of these had actually come off and rolled out, and of course he'd sadly had a fatal accident. His brother followed him on, Graham Herring.
Let's stick to Thompson, because he was in Thompson.
But he was, but what I'm saying was he was actually following this person actually down on his dive, and actually had his gun camera on by a strange coincidence, really. And it was very helpful because they could see exactly the way that this 230-gallon tank came off, and very quickly they were able to re-strengthen it and put baffles in so that the baffles stopped the fuel slopping around so much, to prevent also extra strain and stress. And they were remarkably good tanks. But really the point about John Thompson is really what I'm saying is he was a good pilot, but what it demonstrated as much as anything was how good the squadron was itself in terms of developing people, because there he was, at the end of his, towards the closing last 2 or 3 months on the squadron when I arrived. And I can remember his leading either a 4 or a 6 ship operational strike. And that was a remarkable achievement for somebody at that level in his flying experience. In other words, towards the end of his flying tour. And obviously he'd been overdeveloped or fast-forwarded by the Radfan. Really what I'm saying is it said as much about the squadron that he was on, that on 43, that he was developed in such a way that he could do that. And it was, a remarkably good achievement, I think, and showed how, in the right circumstances, how youngsters can do extremely well. And he went on to go back to be on fighter reconnaissance and then work his way very rapidly up the Air Force. A very pleasant chap. I mean, most people thought he was a Scot because he sounded like a Scot, but in fact he was an Ulsterman.
So what happens next? What anything else happened while you were there? Any other topics you'd like to raise of relevance?
Yes, well, quite quickly, Behan became more important. Now, Behan was a long way from Aden. It was way over 100 miles. I think it was about 120 miles, so to be quite honest, I forget. But we had to go round the corner too, because there was a quirk, a big sort of loop on the map where the Yemen border came in and round. So one used to have to fly round and back down, so to speak, from the far end to get up at Behan. But gradually Behan became more important, and we had to do these patrols up there, and they were politically necessary because there'd been incursions from MiG aircraft from the Yemenis, and probably with Egyptian pilots and or Yemeni pilots with the Russians, who'd come across, or it might even have been East Germans then. No, I think it was the odd Russian people and Egyptians with their MiGs. And sadly, I got the date somewhere, but there was an incident really that affected 43, where I'm almost certain that it was a guy called Peter Skinner on his first tour, and they were at low level, and he actually saw the incursion MiG that was over our side of the border, but was having some transmission problems on the RT with his leader, who I think was, from memory, was Barney Lydiot, who later was on transport flying. And very sadly, and perhaps academically correctly, although he saw this MIG, in his mind was the almost unwritten law that was drilled into you that you never broke a pair up. But in that instance, because you'd be more vulnerable as two singletons, this was the idea. But against that, if you were at extremely low level and got down very low, you were normally pretty safe, because I mean you're a very difficult target, and if you got low down you could see other aircraft more easily. And all I'm sadly saying was probably for a fleeting time, which was probably seconds, half a minute or something like that, he'd got that opportunity. But in his mind, a more experienced pilot would have probably said, sod it, you know, there's no other threat, seen the MIG and have welcomed the opportunity to break, even in those circumstances, to go off and shoot it down. Because, I mean, you don't get an opportunity like that too often, and it might well have been a very good thing if that MIG had been taken down on that incursion. But it was a very interesting little sort of illustrative incident, and that was up at Beihan. But part of the reason that I'm mentioning that was that and one or two other incidents, although we did have strikes across Marib earlier, that the John Jennings had been involved with the OC strike wing, where we'd struck a target just over the border, and there'd been a tremendous amount of international press about it all because we'd crossed the border. But at the same time, it was done as a measured response. But there had been political repercussions about it. So Beihan patrols, all I'm saying is quite a lot of diverted activity was going up to that, and you had to go up at high level and then descend down. And I can remember again vividly when the Ministry of Defence were very slow clearing us for crossing the border. Once we were all armed up and we were sent off to attack a ferret that had been stolen and taken across the border. It was a slightly unsavoury story to do with a relative of this person that had taken the ferret, that had stolen the ferret, and he was supposed to be linked up with somebody up at Beihan. But the sad thing of the story was that there we were, we'd been tasked as an operational mission. They had at least 20 minutes to talk to Whitehall and get clearance for us to cross the border and take this ferret out, to just stop it and let the bloke get out and just take it out, which was a very attractive little target, a ferret like that. And the political decision wasn't there until next morning again, because we were on afternoons the next morning. The next morning I was tasked with effectively finding this across the border, which was almost totally ridiculous, because there were so many, the area that he could have been in by then was absolutely massive. And to hunt for a target like that, you know, over such a large area in the sand was virtually impossible then, by the time that Whitehall had said, go ahead and we want it done. And it was just an interesting example of a decision delayed becoming a bad decision. What else? We've mentioned forward air control, which is often the way for close air support in the Radfan area. Radfan was almost a prescribed area, and in certain parts of it, if you were fired on, you could actually fire back. But we, for most of the time after Radfan, it was an area that we didn't go into, because we didn't want to exacerbate things unless we had to. And it was a relatively small area, Radfan, but there were other trouble spots around, which used to flare up. And I mentioned the Wadi Yaha and the Barna and some other tribal areas, and some of them were quite difficult to hit and sometimes we had six aircraft and sometimes even eight to do these strikes. And if there were eight of you or even six of you, if you were at the front, you'd end up in the queue being behind the number six by the time you went round. And I can remember being behind the new strike wing commander, Martin Chandler, who was out there, who sadly no longer alive, but he'd been out in Korea, and he knew I was watching him on his dive. And what was very good was, as a wing commander, he was there flying with us, which was really splendid. And he knew that I was behind him, and because I'd sort of caught him up, and that he'd fired slightly out of range. But at the same time, it didn't bother me at all, because it was so good that he was prepared to fly as on the squadron like that. And I'll never forget when we landed, he came up to me and he looked me in the eyes and he said in Korea I did learn a thing or two. And what he was saying, of course, was that if there'd been enemy fire, he could remember from his and it was fascinating, really.
That was Wing Commander
Martin Chandler. Yeah, his real initials were ES. I really don't know what the E stood for, whether it was Eric or what, I don't know, but everyone called him Martin, to the confusion, because there were at least three Martin Chandlers in the Air Force. But he'd been out in Korea on 84s, I think, doing strike work. And it was a rather pleasant link, that, just as I said, with Bush Barry on 4 Squadron, who'd been in fighters in the war. Other roles out there and other memories. I once had to do a carefully briefed flag wave, but for reasons I didn't understand, but must have been very valid, one imagines, because from the local political element, that would go through to some tasking agency, and then it would be passed down to the squadrons what we were to do. But I was given slightly Irish instructions, where I had only two aircraft, but I had to pretend, literally, this was my orders on the Form Delta or whatever it was that we had to tell us what to do. And I had to pretend to be eight aircraft. And this was very relevant to what subsequently happened, because you have to be quite original to go round, attack a target, and disappear down the wadi beds and come round from completely different directions. That's the only way I could think of doing it.
So this wasn't just a deterrent, it's an actual attack.
Yeah, that was what I was saying earlier, was a flag wave. And it was really to show a threatening hostile intention without opening fire, and it was really almost as a kind of warning area, and that actually was up in the Wadi Yaha, because I can remember. And the only way one could do it was obviously on those instructions, which were conveniently forgotten about once I landed, because when we landed, both of us had been hit, and nobody had been hit for, I suppose, 10 months or something like that. I'm pretty certain. Maybe one of the recce aircraft were on one of their special things. But then I had to fill in the hostile action report, and I've just by complete coincidence, I've got it there. And of course, there's no on that report. It doesn't say the key thing about what we were told to do. That somehow we've got to pretend to be four times as many aircraft as we had. And then, of course, it was nice and easy for them when I got down, and that we'd both been hit, that somehow I'd done things wrongly. And I filled in this hostile action report, and I think I actually went off on leave then. And I was, not at all happy later, where they were saying, oh, well, and they'd completely forgotten what the original brief was. And I mean, in a way, I thought, good luck to them for hitting us for once, but it showed that the hunter was quite good. Obviously, it was only light.
Which Hunter light is this?
That Hunter 9s. We had Hunter 9s there. FGA 9s, Fighter Ground Attack 9s.
That's new, because the conversion course was Hunter 6.
Yeah,
sorry. What did you think of the Hunter 9?
Oh, splendid. Absolutely great in the role, because we had the capability to use... normally, we only used to fire from memory 12 rather than 16 rockets. Because I think if you had 16 rockets, you tended to throw them a bit more. Sometimes we had 16, but I think more often it was 6 on each side. I think we found that was a better arrangement for accuracy and what have you. But and then, of course, you know, we had control over our four guns, so we'd fire them in pairs. Sometimes we'd fire all four, sometimes, but almost invariably it would be a pair at a time. And we wouldn't always, sometimes we'd only use two guns and come back. And sometimes we'd fire two guns and then swap them and fire the other two. But they were extremely accurate, the Hunter's guns.
Anything else? I mean, was this the one you thought was best of breed?
Yes.
Your friend thought it was a 6, but
well,
you think it's
no, no, no. He thought it was the FR-10.
Right.
I mean, on his book, that's his book, The Hunter in Fighter Reconnaissance. And he was just saying that for once, and this was the interesting thing when I wrote to him about it, was that, you know, it had the offset compass, which was a good idea, and various other ways they'd offset the gun sight slightly to make it very useful for reconnaissance.
Now, what about the Hunter 9 then? What was good about that? What developments were there?
Well,
the
6, it really had the long-range tanks and hard points on it, so that it could take... The Hunter 6 was developed later with the 6A almost became a sort of part way to a 9, but really the Hunter 9 had the important thing that it had more than anything was the parachute out the back for short landings. And interestingly, I'll go on to talk about landing at Beihan to do with that brake parachute, but the other element was the long range 230 gallon tanks that we had on our inboards, and the capability to redeploy, because we had the automatic direction finding, and that really was almost a contradiction of terms, because in actual fact the ADF was or NDB, the other way around it, the non-directional beacon. It's a bit confusing, but from a navigational viewpoint, the NDB on the Hunter was pretty poor. It was a very poor man's automatic direction finder, and when we redeployed from UK later, and from my own point of view, you know, navigationally, it was a pretty poor aid in many ways, compared with what I've spoken about the TACAN,
the thing you had in the net.
Yeah, in the net.
Now, so
because we did. Sorry, what I was saying really was that depending on when you did your Hunter simulator emergencies, your HSE course back in UK, people would often fly back with an aircraft or fly out after doing a Hunter simulator's emergency course every year. Sometimes they'd come down the route to bring aircraft out. And the other way round, what was even more important, and what I haven't mentioned, was how well the Hunter did there. In that environment, because it was a very demanding environment for all the aircraft, because of the combination of sand, dust, ingress into anywhere and everywhere, you know, in terms of components, and the effect of salty sand as well out there. It was a very demanding climate, and to this day, the Middle East is probably one of the most demanding environments for aircraft. What I haven't mentioned was that out there were 105 Squadron with the Argosies for medium range transport. The VC-10s would come in with on the transport side, but also out there was 78 Squadron, which was the old Pioneers, twin Pioneers there, which were landing on the upcountry strip sometimes, and sometimes one would do top cover for them on that front. And later, Andovers would come in on that front for 78 Squadron. You'd still see the old Dakotas from Aden Airways going out sometimes, which was rather good, still in service out there. And also the Wessexes came in, and I went up once on a Wessex. I think when we were actually dropped in when I was up country from Thumir. And I came back, I haven't mentioned the Beverleys, because the Beverleys did very well out there. 84 Squadron were the Beverleys, and I remember flying back from Habberlane. I went up with the Army Air Corps to Habberlane in a Beaver and came back in a Beverley when I went up for 3 days or whatever it was with the SAS. There were two station commanders when I was there, but for most of the time it was Beetham, later Sir Michael Beetham, who became Chief of Air Staff, and it was the busiest station in the Air Force then, and you could see it was a really crowded with squadrons and aircraft and activity. And Johnny Johnson was the Air Officer Commanding to start with, and rather surprisingly, I don't think he was seen so much with eight. And intriguingly, in Nigel's book, he talks as though Johnny Johnson was down a lot at strike wing, but I would almost disagree with that entirely, although our viewpoint might have been coloured by just the days we were on, because I can never remember Johnny Johnson being down anywhere near strike wing myself, and it was slightly sad. And I can remember the other squadron also talking, even though we didn't see that much of each other because of the way we operated. And in your 24 hours off, which obviously weren't 24 hours, but it did give you a time to go down for the relaxation down at the Tarshine Club, Tarshine Bay, where it was swimming, and there was a sort of shark net there, which normally worked. I think there were a couple of incidents there, but there were obviously increasing amount of terrorist activity in Mala and Steamer Point and Kamaxa and around there. But it sort of got slightly less in the middle of my time out there. And then just as I was leaving, it started becoming heavier again, the amount. But as I say, until the political announcement was made to the world that we were withdrawing in 1967, it did not appear to be that bad, because often the incidents, seemed a little amateurish in many ways. But later they did become bad, and the two groups that were vying for political groups were the NLF, the National Liberation Front, and FLOSSI, the whatever FLOSSI standard, something for the Liberation of South Yemen was the second lot. I'm trying to think what the F stood for. But at the end of the day, I think the NLF came out in charge right at the end. And you really felt for the people that for so many years on the Sheikh side had been the Sheikhdom areas, upcountry and elsewhere, that had been loyal to the British. You felt what a tragic turn of events it was for them, because we were leaving them sadly to, you know, sounds a ridiculous thing to say there, to be hung out to dry, because the situation did alter very rapidly before and after we actually went, although the evacuation was a very successful operation, but that was after I'd left.